Welcome to Grand Wire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Grand Wire was produced on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit. This episode of Grand Wire will look back at some stories from the first half of 2018. Here is your 2018 year in review. First, some headlines from the first half of 2018. Our first headline is from our January 29th episode, covering the National Day of Action in support of Tim Hortons workers by Kathy Inayu at CKUT. The new year saw the rise in the minimum wage across the country as a result of the hard work and advocacy of the labor movement in Canada. However, with the raise in the minimum wage, some multinational corporations, such as Tim Hortons, took it as an opportunity to roll back worker benefits and worker rights. Pam Frake organizes with the Fight for 15 campaign in Ontario.
Like cutting back on paid breaks, cutting back on access to basic health and dental benefits, like forcing people to pay for their uniforms, eliminating, eliminating the one coffee and donut that people are allowed to have when they finish their shift. That has been eliminated.
In response, the Fight for 15 and Fairness campaign called for a national day of action in support of workers at Tim Hortons on January 19th across the country to send a message about decent work and wages.
We want to send a message that it is not business as usual with Tim Hortons so long as they are clawing back those workers' wages. And we simply cannot stop until Tim Hortons makes it right by its employees.
Our next headline is from February 26th. Covering survivors who condemned the 1960 Scoop Settlement in Manitoba by Michael Welsh from CKUW in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Our next headline comes to us from the contributor Michael Welsh with radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, broadcasting from the occupied territory of the Anishinaabe and the homeland of the Métis Nation. An $800 million settlement package meant to compensate victims from the so-called 60 Scoop was condemned by a number of survivors of that tragedy at the recent Winnipeg press conference. Participants in the conference argued that the federal government, in presenting the argument last fall, had not responsibly consulted with thousands of Indigenous people who, as children, were removed from their communities and placed with non-Indigenous families between 1952 and 1991, often with tragic results. Filmmaker and journalist Colleen Rajati, speaking on behalf of herself and other Scoop survivors, explained during an exclusive interview with CKUW that First Nations children suffer wildly different outcomes through no choice of their own.
Many adoptees were sent to horrible, horrible homes used for slave labor in the United States, beaten, suffered all forms of abuse. No one asked us where we were going to be placed. We had no say in our lives. It was like a crapshoot where we ended up. I just through a fluke, I could have ended up in Pennsylvania or Minnesota, California.
Colleen explained that she read the entire agreement and was outraged by its content.
I was astounded to see that, if adoptees sign this agreement, you are giving up your rights to sue for physical and sexual abuse. The lawyers in this package are going to be compensated $75 million. $75 million split between four law firms. Adoptees are being offered anywhere between $25,000 to $50,000. The fact that these four law firms are going to make that amount of money on the backs of survivors that have lost so much just really is really upsetting.
A Facebook page is being set up called Manitoba 60 Scoop Survivors, which will post the agreement and attempt to organize survivors behind a more fair agreement.
Finally, a headline from May 7th on toxic misogyny and the Toronto van attack by Mick Sweetman at CJRU in Toronto, Ontario.
Our final headline comes from CJRU, broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and most recently the territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation. On April 23rd, a man mowed down pedestrians on a busy sidewalk in North York, Toronto, killing 10 and injuring 16 others. CJRU spoke to Mohini Dattery from the North York Women's Shelter about the ubiquity of femicide and the internet as the culprit for misogynistic discourse.
The connection between violence against women, misogyny, and mass murders is inextricably linked. OAuth, which is the Ontario Association of Interval and Transitional Houses, collect a femicide list every year. Last year, it was over 30 women who were killed. And then this year, we think it's almost around 20 already. I think we really need to pay attention to the fact that this has existed long before the internet. Men's rights activist groups existed long before the internet. The Montreal massacre happened pre-internet. The violence towards Indigenous women and girls, long before the internet. So I'm really hesitant to blame the internet for misogyny or any way sort of make that link. We are a misogynist society. I think we just have to take ownership of that. However, there's definitely been an escalation. And I think the internet itself has become a more hostile place to women and people of color. And I think that those bounds are maintained through violence. So that angry rhetoric is a form of violence on the internet. And then we see it playing out in spectacular ways. What looks like exceptional violence informs ban attacks and then drawing that back to sort of internet culture. But the fact is, this is very everyday. It's happening all the time. Sometimes we have these moments where it breaks through the surface and everyone starts to pay attention. Above all, I think we need attention and funding from council and the mayor, and also addressing the issues that we have already been calling for. So things around safe, accessible housing, anti-poverty, a city that's becoming this unaffordable for exactly those vulnerable populations that we're talking about that are then targeted by the alt-right.
You are tuned into Grand Wire Year in Review, your source for news from the ground up. Available online at groundwirenews.ca and airing on your community radio station. Now, we look back at some features from the first half of 2018 on Grand Wire. Our first feature comes from our February 12th episode, covering January 29th commemoration vigils in Winnipeg, Toronto, and Montreal by Alain Weinberg at CKUW, Chelsea Gould at CJRU, and Gao Mahadevan at CKUT.
To commemorate the first year anniversary of the January 29th mosque massacre, where six worshippers were murdered by an Islamophobic white supremacist, communities across Canada hosted vigils to remember the victims and stand in solidarity with the Muslim community. We bring you coverage from the vigils that took place in Winnipeg, Toronto, and Montreal.
In Winnipeg, the commemoration of the anniversary of the tragedy in Quebec was held inside the Manitoba Legislative Building. Close to 100 community members, including political figures at the civic, provincial, and federal level, were on hand to mark the significance of the occasion. Alain Weinberg, programmer with campus community station CKUW 95.9 FM, was present at the event. Here he is speaking with fellow programmer Michael Welsh about what transpired.
So on the 29th, this last week in Winnipeg, along with places throughout the country, was a commemoration of this massacre. And this was held indoors at the Manitoba Legislature. Thankfully indoors, it was a very cold night. And people came from a lot of different walks of life and communities. I don't think it was broadly advertised or promoted, but there was a good diversity of folks. And they had various speakers. There was someone from the Bear Clan. The Bear Clan is a North End based, though not exclusively, an Indigenous-led and run community watch kind of group.
I think that regardless of where we come from, regardless of what journey we come from, we need to take a stand in our communities, not just to help those who are cold, those who are hurt, but we also need to make an effort to have a better
One speaker that was at the end that was quite prominent and that's always very inspiring is Shahina Siddiqui, the head of ISSA, the Islamic Social Services Association. She does a lot to bring people together and really universalize the experience of all people who are here, newcomer or not, Indigenous or of immigrant background, settler or otherwise. And Shahina did speak at the end, and I think she made a strong message, which is that it shouldn't be up to her and her people and her community to always be holding these kinds of events. I think it's a burnout recipe for burnout for any individual or community to feel the burden of needing to unify people.
I appreciate your messages that we have been receiving this entire month of solidarity, of compassion, and of mercy. As we leave today, please please remember that the Muslim community is praying for you, for our country, as much as we pray for ourselves.
I don't know. It was a humbling and mellow and definitely a grounding event.
We will not be silent in the face of fascist violence! We will not be silent in the face of fascist violence!
Over 100 people gathered at Nathan Phillips Square on Saturday to counter Islamophobia and remember the victims of last year's Quebec City mosque shooting. Hosted by Solidarity Against Fascism Everywhere and Toronto IWW General Defense Committee Local 28, it was originally organized to counter a rally planned by PETIGA Canada. Safiya Gahadar, University of Toronto professor and former QP 3907 president, says that Canadians believe that it only exists in the South.
This has escalated, and let's not pretend, you know, because the usual talk that I hear all the time on campuses and with my friends is we're always constantly pointing down to the South, right? We are always looking down South when the shootings happen. When Trump, we are blaming Trump, oh, he started it. No, this has been ongoing. And when we look at the country, the history of the Canada, we have to remember,
no justice, no peace. No justice, no peace.
Communities, they can organize themselves in a way to educate other people and get their community involved. And that's from that we can apply pressure on the government and ask them and demand them actually to actually have some action, right? To pass like policies to, as Black Lives Matter achieved last year, right? Like in Toronto, which is like not having police in schools anymore. So when communities get organized, right, with different groups, that's how we can get things done.
For CJRU, I'm Chelsea Gould.
Important for Muslims such as myself, who feel this kind of shock and disbelief, to remember that this event forms part of a history of violence against Muslims in North America. Our predecessors and parents experienced it and told us about it. We ourselves have experiences in our own life histories. Paki bashing, securitization, the pressure to assimilate and give up our languages or our choice of dress. We know that these histories are subfields of the centuries-long history of white supremacist violence against North American people of color. We know that in 2007, six people were murdered at a Sikh place of worship, a gurdwara, in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. In 2015, nine people were killed at a black church in Charleston. I also remember that broader history today. I'm a professor, I'm not an imam or a sheikh. Especially today, I'm not comfortable with telling Muslims as a group what they should do or what they should not do, even from my insider position, even as advice. So I'll address only one Muslim, myself. It is as important for me to recognize and support the struggles of other oppressed and marginalized peoples as it is to demand recognition of the specific violence of Islamophobia. Solidarity within the Muslim community is most important, but so is solidarity with similarly oppressed people, not only along racial lines. However much the media essentializes Muslims as misogynistic and homophobic, it is important for me to learn from, aid in, and make sure that I am not myself an obstacle to the resistances of women, queer, and trans people, especially those within my own communities of Muslims and South Asians.
Next, a feature from February 26th, covering the Day of Action Seeking Justice for Colton Bushi by Trina Slapkoff at CKUT.
Colton Bushi, a 22-year-old from Red Pheasant Cree Nation in Saskatchewan, was shot and killed by a farmer in August 2016. On February 9th, the jury and judge ruled that Gerald Stanley was acquitted of all charges with regard to the murder of Colton. In honor of the late Colton Coco Bushi, organizers across so-called Canada called for a day of action to show solidarity and support for the Bushi and Baptiste family. The Montreal installment of the actions was held at the Norman Bethune Square in downtown Montreal.
Can I ask you why you came to the Colton Bushy rally today?
Yes, I think I'm here for the same reason a lot of people are here, and that's that a year and a half ago we had really a horrible tragedy in the death of Colton. But I think the reason we're here today is because of a horrible injustice that happened on Friday. And that injustice was when the jury found a man who admitted to doing something illegal not guilty. And I don't think the biggest challenge there was the fact that there wasn't an Indigenous person on that jury, is that a jury of non-Indigenous people saw the evidence that I think we were presented with as a community and decided that this guy was not culpable for his actions. Indigenous people are dehumanized, and I think it's only until we move beyond that and see the humanity in Indigenous peoples that we'll see stuff like the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women coming to an end, and at the same time seeing justice for when some objectively horrible things happen to members of our community.
This is a gross injustice. I think everybody who was watching this unfold could see how unjust and how systemically racist this was. There was an all-white jury. This person is dead. He's permanently lost to his family, to his community, to his relatives. This is a massive injustice, and anybody who's not shaken to their core has to really question what they know about the situation in Canada.
Can I ask you what brought you to the Colton Bushy rally today?
Yes, of course. Well, the reason I decided to come was because I grew up in Nunavut, and I noticed growing up that even though Nunavut was created by Inuit and for Inuit, it really was not reflecting that, and we have such a power imbalance between Inuit and non-Indigenous people, and there's so much segregation within our society that I've always felt the need to help the rest of Canada understand that there's so much going on in Indigenous communities, and there's so much oppression and so much racism that we're not seeing because the government looks like it's really working towards reconciliation, but in reality, there's so much happening behind the scenes and so much mistreatment and miscommunication between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Canadians. For example, when we finally signed on to the United Nations Declarations for the Rights of Indigenous People, our justice minister said it's not just feasible to implement that within our government.
The Colton Bushy case happened in August 2016. Here we are, what is it, 2.5 years, maybe getting close to it. And you really, if you wanted to get informed, you really had to read the backstory. It only became big news Friday when the verdict came out.
Thank you to CKUT for that feature.
Finally, a feature from our June 18th episode, covering resistance to the meeting of the G7 leaders in Quebec by Gao Mahadevan at CKUT.
The 44th G7 summit was held the weekend of June 8th and 9th in La Malbaie, Quebec. While world leaders met behind closed doors, community members and social and environmental justice campaigners mobilized in the streets to express their opposition to the G7 agenda. Gao Mahadevan of CKUT in Montreal brings us this report.
The heads of state of seven of the most powerful imperialist and colonialist countries in the world gathered on June 8th and June 9th for the G7 summit in Malbaie, Quebec. Various demonstrations were held in Quebec to protest the G7, capitalism, patriarchy, colonialism, racism, and borders. CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal brings you a sample of their coverage of the resistance efforts in Quebec City. Up first, an interview with the Rage G7, a network of groups that organized a mass demonstration on June 7th in Quebec City.
The RAG 7 is the Réseau de Résistance Anti-G7. It's a resistance network against the G7. What we expect will happen again this year is that the only resolution that will lead to actual action will be the economic resolution. And they want to ensure that the elites that benefit the most from the summit are kept safe. They want to protect the interests of this elite. So the way they do with security is in line with this position. The problem is that they're actually using this money to buy weapons, to equip the police in Quebec and in La Malbaie to use against its own population. We're talking about spending $600 million to fight their home population. So they will arrest people. If they arrest no one, they will look like fools. So no matter what happened in the street, people will be arrested.
Nearly 70% of the summit's $604 million budget was spent on security. More than 8,000 police officers were deployed for the weekend. CKUT spoke to one of the protesters after the June 7th demonstrations about the militarization of the city.
I'm Marie-Hélène Lebel, and I'm here because I'm really concerned about everything that's going on with the G7. The event itself, the money that gets involved in security is getting really scandalous with time. And I think before we were protesting against, you know, the policies and the economical state G7 was representing, but today I think we can only be here because we believe it's scandalous that in this area of cuts and of underfinancing, we spend that much money only to hire police troops. It's kind of absurd, actually. There's so few people, and I think right now there is visibly more people that belong either in the police group or the media groups than the protesters, actually. People are kind of scared. They expect the police to charge on us. So we're kind of staying here to show that we don't believe this is a working democracy when, right from the start, police goes along with the idea that the protesters are going to be criminals. Being part of the 2012 movement, for me this is just a continuation. Actually, when you look at it, there are real guns. We see assault guns in the hands of the policemen. We see how low it goes when you see the site in La Malbaie, where you cannot really go because there are checkpoints on the way to the city of La Malbaie. So I wanted to go tomorrow, and I've seen that it's virtually impossible to get there now because they will stop you if you don't have the right pass. So logically, the only other way we have to protest is here in Quebec, and we see that they expect this to go wrong, and it's kind of a weird ending because it didn't go wrong, and all we see is the police waiting for it to happen.
Shani Piap, an Inuendet artist and activist, spoke to the mainstream press before the mass demonstration on June 7th at Parc de Brève. She deplores the state and the G7 for the continuation of colonialist policies and the role of Indigenous chiefs in accepting secondary economic agreements that enable the state to continue the displacement of Indigenous peoples from their titled land.
Il faut parler en Innu. Je suis contente de parler en Innu. Je vous souhaite la bienvenue, tout le monde, sur les territoires Innu, Wendat, Algonquin, Cri, Atikamek, peuple souverain, Innu, Outapendemoun. Autrefois, nos chefs autochtones signaient des traités pour nous assurer à nous, peuple souverain, Innu Outapendemoun, la continuité de notre vie sauvage. Nous étions une société capable de survivre tout au long de l'année dans l'immensité de notre habitat naturel. Et maintenant, les chefs autochtones de l'an 2000 acceptent des ententes économiques sur nos terres, donnant à vous, au gouvernement canadien et québécois, le droit d'envahir le peu de terres de chasse qui reste aux Premières Nations, et bientôt, avec tout le G7, sans scrupule, les chefs autochtones arrachent à leurs frères et sœurs indigènes leurs droits ancestraux sur le territoire. Tous ces territoires de survie sont dévastés de toutes parts par la politique du colonialisme et par ces chefs devenus, eux aussi, des abuseurs de société. Tous les traités d'amitié et de paix n'ont pas pu assurer notre survie en tant que premier peuple. Malgré les récentes avancées, nous périssons encore de maladies, de drogues, de boissons et de nourriture malsaine. Les nombreuses séquelles apportées par les pensionnats chrétiens à nos enfants, nos générations futures, sont impardonnables. Cela est inconciliable avec le message du Créateur que les hommes de Dieu et les bons gouvernements ont tenté de nous imposer. Votre histoire est dorénavant marquée au fer rouge par leurs agissements, et ce à jamais, que vous le vouliez ou non.
From traditional unceded Mohawk territory in Montreal, this is CKUT's Gao Mahadevan for Groundwire.
You are listening to Groundwire's Year in Review, your source for news from the ground up. Available online at groundwirenews.ca and airing on your local community radio station. Finally, our community radio report from April 10th where members of Radio Centreville demonstrate against the undemocratic commercialization of its airwaves by Eva Batut at CKUT.
On Wednesday, March 29th, members of Radio Centreville demonstrated against the undemocratic commercialization of its airwaves. Many of the multilingual community radio station members have been protesting against the selling of airtime since the summer of 2016.
Radio Centreville has been broadcasting in Montreal since 1975 and provides programming to 8 different linguistic groups in the city.
On Wednesday, 29th of March, members of the multilingual community radio Radio Centreville demonstrated due to the selling of radio airtimes in a non-democratic way and against the will of the members. Financial cuts to community radio is not a one-off event, but a structural transformation enabled by current austerity measures that have continued to cut public funding and increase privatization. Javiera, member of this radio, is explaining us the context.
It's a long story. This starts like 1 year ago when we used to have a big amount of money that came from Centraide. This was a big part of our funding for Radio Centreville, which is a community radio. So that's the first thing to retain. If you don't know anything about Radio Centreville, the first thing to know is this is a community radio. So there is a group of members. The members decide what we're going to do with the radio, and there is a board like CKUT. What happened? Since this big amount of money was cut, we weren't having this. The radio wasn't receiving this amount of money. There was this big economic crisis at the radio, and one group of people, of members of the radio who were in the board at that point, decided to start selling airtime, which is a problem because the members didn't agree with that. The members in an assembly, they said, no, we don't want to sell airtime. We would like to look for another alternative ways of making the radio function, that like asking for other kind of money from governments. Or even it's not, the radio members are not against selling airtime in itself. What is the problem is that the way board is doing, what they're doing. So they are selling airtime like 1 hour. Someone can buy 1 hour of airtime in Radio Centreville on 2.3 FM. So you have 1 hour, and then you can sell it in that hour. You can sell advertisements. So you can have 10 or, I don't know, 20 people paying you, and you make money. You can actually make money from that. So we don't agree with that kind of selling of airtime at the radio, but especially we don't agree with the fact that it has been made against the will of the assembly of members. So the board has used a different strategies to go around the decision of the members. The members are not respected. The last General Assembly was completely a fraud with members who weren't actually members of the radio board.
That's it for your Groundwire Year in Review, covering stories from the first half of 2018. Thank you to all our amazing contributors this year, and join us again on our next episode where we will look back at the second half of 2018. You are tuned in to Groundwire, your source for community radio news, available online at groundwirenews.ca and airing on your local community radio station.